Okay, great. So welcome, everyone. So it's a real pleasure to welcome back Salim Hotinli. Salim did his PhD at Imperial College London. And during his PhD, he was a frequent visitor to Perimeter, collaborating with several of us on topics mostly related to under the CMB. Salim is currently a postdoc at Johns Hopkins, and he very kindly agreed to tell us today about some of his recent work on fundamental physics from CMB secondaries. So Salim, please go ahead whenever you're ready.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Hi, everyone. Yeah, thanks, Neil, for the opportunity to speak to everyone about some ongoing work. So as I said, it will be the things that we do in collaboration with some of the people here, but maybe there are some new people as well. So hopefully for some, at least, this will be relatively authentic stuff, but apologize if it's not. As Neil said, I had various collaborators, including quite a few from Imperial Perimeter as well. I'll be talking about some of the work as well as some of the new work, related to those as well. So let me just go back to the title. I think I can summarize what I want to talk about is essentially learning fundamental physics from CMB secondaries. I will assume you can see my cursor. CMB secondaries are, for those who don't know, essentially the effects on the CMB, the signals that are other than the primordial CMB. So these might be due to weak lensing, Singer-Zeldovich type scattering, as well as other lensing-like effects. So I'll be talking about quite a few of those in what follows. And the goal of the talk will be to introduce the program of reconstructing the cosmological modes or fluctuations from measurement of small-scale CMB and galaxy density. So I really want to demonstrate that, you know, this program, it's not only a way to probe fundamental properties of the universe, but it will actually probably be, or maybe it is, representative of a change in the way that we do cosmology in the future, where these kind of observations of small-scale fluctuations will actually constitute to one of the most competitive ways to probe fundamental physics with CMB surveys in cross-correlation with galaxy surveys. This is especially the case, I think, when going beyond the cosmic variance limited power spectra measurements. So I'll be talking about all of that in this talk. So to that end, I'll be first introducing primordial signatures that are of interest to this program, or at least some of them, before describing the set of observables which can be utilized to reconstruct bulk velocity fields and the remote quadrupole fields in order to probe landscapes of such signatures. So please feel free to interrupt me at any point, especially if anything is unclear, since I'll be covering a relatively wide range of topics in a sort of a high concept-ish talk. So, at the center of our understanding, at the center of our understanding, our phenomenological understanding of the universe is the Lambda-CDM model, which describes, you know, the standard evolution, the structure of the structure succeeding inflation. However, in the near future, you know, there will be an influx of fantastic experiments, you know, putting the predictions of Lambda-CDM to its most stringent test. So even smaller, small deviations from its predictions when measured robustly can probably revolutionize, you know, our understanding of cosmology. So motivated by all of this, one of the main objects of interest for me is initial conditions. So especially going beyond the simplest Gaussian isotropic adiabatic characteristics and so on. So better to understand the phenomena of inflation and or predictions, as well as, you know, other phenomena that might be relevant for at the very early times in our universe. So let me just go over a few of those things to just introduce the kinds of things that I'm interested in. So inflation is one for sure. So the simplest model of inflation is, of course, the single field slow roll model, where inflation inflaton field slowly rolls over its potential over a period of accelerated expansion, followed by it reaching its minima and eventually decaying into what constitutes to the cosmic inventory as we see and measure on this day. But even as this simplest, like simple, very simple model is up to some scrutiny in the near future, as the many simplest inflationary potentials predict large primordial tensor perturbations that might be detectable with increasing sensitivity in the upcoming and ongoing experiments. So this is a plot, for example, where the CMB BMEL fluctuations are shown. And then you also see the contribution. Well, you see the contribution from the weak Lansing fluctuations on the BMEL CMB, together with contribution from the primordial tensor mounts, parametrized here with R, which is the tensor to scalar ratio. And you can see that even small values of R, such as 10 to the minus 2, you know, should leave an imprint comparable to the Lansing modes on large scales. So as a result, we already are beginning to push the constraints on R significantly, to the extent where the standard monomial inflationary potential models, for example, are becoming less and less likely to satisfy observations. So that means, like, in other words, we might be at a place where in the near future, thanks to experiments such as CMB stage 4, for example, you know, essentially we'll have to change like all of our textbooks, which use and teaches undergrad students, like this type of potential, for example. It's not the end of the world, but it might be possible. So in the later parts of the talk, I'll be discussing how this program can actually contribute to our like probing and understanding of the inflationary phenomena as well, with these tensor fluctuations. The tensor modes are not the only interesting prediction of the simplest inflationary models. So one very valuable signature, for example, is non-Gaussianity. So where you have new and unique information that appears on, you know, higher order statistical correlations of the primordial density fluctuations. So these might be, you know, 3-point functions or 4-point functions, and so on, for which the single field slow roll models predict very small amounts. So we expect, you know, the early noise to be quite Gaussian in the absence of complicated dynamics. So one particular signature is the amplitude of 3-point non-Gaussianities that are of the squeeze form or the local form or the local shape in the Fourier space. So it's, in other words, these are combinations of like one wavelength, one long wavelength and two short wavelength modes throughout the sky, whose amplitude is defined as FNL. And these are expected to be, I mean, the amplitude is expected to be small, smaller than one generally for single field models. And more importantly, I think, it is also expected to be large for multi-inflationary models where inflation dynamics is dictated by not only one, but multiple fields. So measuring this amplitude, as I'll discuss in a minute, below one is pretty important, and, you know, and that would make a large, you know, portion of the inflationary theory landscape less likely. But also importantly, for simple single field slower models, the amplitude of the higher order squeeze forms of non-Gaussianity, such as the collapsed 4-point function, is essentially geometrically related to the FNL. Or in other words, if we measure or have a prediction for the FNL, like the bispectra, the squeeze bispectra amplitudes, that would constitute also to a prediction of the amplitude of the collapsed 4-point, which we call tau NL. So seeing whether, you know, what we measure the tau NL to be is what is predicted by FNL, for example, as I'll discuss soon, is also a direct, you know, test of single field slow roll. You know, it would turn out like it would give us an idea whether, you know, these inflation, these predictions from the inflation hold, like the single field inflation hold, or do we need other fields that might source 4-point fluctuations that might, that cannot be explained, you know, by only essentially squaring the 3-point functions together. So I'll get back to this very soon. So other signatures, of course, include isocurvature. So it is possible to show, you know, that if the earlier universe dynamics is governed by a single field, the solution of the equations of motion are all adiabatic. In other words, you know, single field slow roll models predict adiabatic initial conditions, you know, where fluctuations in baryons called dark matter and neutrinos all follow each other. And detecting a deviation from this in any of these components is, especially if it's formed primordially, can be very important. It can be an important discovery. We also expect various parity symmetries to be conserved in the universe. However, if the physics, you know, behind dark energy or dark matter violate the parity symmetry predicted by the standard cosmological paradigm, the plane of linear polarization of the CMB photons can rotate due to their coupling to the dark sector, for example. So there are like recent 3 sigma like hints of cosmic birefringence, this cosmic birefringence observed in the EB spectrum. We can also search for the TB spectrum. So these are not to be expected if the parity symmetries are conserved using the CMB polarization data. And this is so it's pretty motivated at this point to pursue, you know, the most promising directions for improving this type of measurement and or validating it through other methods, you know, that are subject to other systematics. So I'll be talking about that as well. Let's see, I'm not going to be talking about the this type of thing, but you know, other signatures also include non-standard model heavy particle production during the early epochs of the universe. So this would lead to unique forms of correlations later in the structure formation, or it might introduce various features on the power spectra as well. But I think I'm not going to mention this in this talk. Let's see. Yeah, so there are some works that show that, you know, you can actually get oscillatory patterns on the power spectra as well. Okay, so in addition to, you know, initial conditions, another thing that interests me is the growth of structure, which also carries a lot of information about fundamental physics, you know, through its sensitivity, for example, to number of free streaming degrees of freedom and their masses, to dark energy, to gravity, you know, to dark matter, all of these things. So I'll be mentioning some or all of these things in the rest of the talk. Okay, so in what remains, I will be discussing how the upcoming high precision measurements of various CMB secondaries can actually allow improving our ability to probe many of these phenomena, especially when using cross correlation with large scale structure. So I'll be particularly focusing on kinematic and polarized Sinusoidal-Deutsch effects, as well as the moving lens effect, and consider cross-correlating these with the galaxy surveys, and also in one case with the 21 centimeter hydrogen line. Okay, so any questions so far? This was like a introduction to what I'll be talking about. Okay, cool. I think I can hear you if people say things. So. Okay, so let me begin by discussing the KSC effect, the kinematic Sinusoidal-Deutsch effect. So this is due to scattering of the CMB photons of energetic electrons in cluster mediums and getting Doppler shifted due to radial peculiar velocities of electrons. So it introduces this type of pattern on the CMB sky, and it can be written as shown here, where which is essentially a line integral over the radial velocity and the electron density. So this effect will be detected to, you know, very high accuracy with the upcoming CMB experiments in cross correlation with the upcoming galaxy surveys, as shown in this table, for example. And then you can see on this figure here, the significance of the KSC on the CMB temperature, where you can see that it would dominate the blackbody contribution to the signal, you know, at scales beyond a few thousand multipoles. So there are larger foregrounds, such as the CIB, the cosmic infrared background, and the thermal SC effects. But these are frequency dependent, and their frequency dependence is different than blackbody. So as we push down the noise of the CMB experiments, you know, and more and more effectively remove the frequency dependent contributions, it is perhaps appropriate to say that, you know, all we will be measuring in from the small-scale CMB blackbody fluctuations in the near future will be KSC effect. So it's pretty important. Okay, so let me just describe a little bit on how we get cosmology out of it. So velocity tomography essentially refers to the technique of accessing large-scale velocity modes from the small-scale CMB measurements. So in the case of KSC, it is the large-scale bulk radial velocities, you know, we're interested in, and these redistribute the correlation between the small-scale CMB temperature and electrons. So this is pretty analogous to, you know, lensing modes redistributing temperature autocorrelations on the CMB maps. But in this case, we will be interested in temperature cross correlations with some, you know, density tracer or the electron tracer, which gets redistributed over the sky due to the radial velocity modes, you know, varying. So in other words, like if I happen to look at some patch in the universe with certain bulk velocity and calculate how the observed CMB looks like and how it is correlated with the electrons on small scales, and I go to some other patch and I do the same, I would see that this cross correlation varies over the sky in a way, tracing the underlying differences, you know, between radial velocities. So here's a little plot. I think this is like a sort of a sketch I did a while back, where, you know, you can see like where the velocity is small or zero. Let's imagine these like smallest numbers are zero here. You don't really see much KSC or any KSC, whereas, you know, where the radial velocity is large, you see the KSC contribution to the CMB more. More clearly. So the principle behind essentially reconstructing the velocity modes will be, or the method we'll be using, is to cross correlating with galaxy surveys. So we'll be taking like galaxy surveys as tracers of the underlying electron distribution, cross correlate them with the CMB, and see about how the radial velocity varies this cross correlation over the sky. So in that sense, it's actually pretty analogous to the lensing quadratic estimator. In this case, we have the velocity quadratic estimator, which is a squeezed bispectrum estimation. And I like this little sketch by Matt from a while back, where it kind of shows in sort of Fourier space, like how these modes are related. So we'll be using, or we use in general, a CMB mode on the transverse plane connected by a galaxy mode, essentially giving us an estimation for the velocity itself. Okay, so let me go on to describe why we do this and what are the benefits of velocity reconstruction. So one of the the very immediate benefit of utilizing the KSC measurements in this kind of way comes from observation that. You know, one really reconstructs is the velocity fields on large scales, in that the reconstruction noise is flat in velocity, so it's like shot noise in velocity. So, you know, when constraining density fluctuations, for example, which are different by an inverse wave number, as shown here, the noise scales with an extra k factor. So that means like when noise really becomes super large when compared to matter fluctuations when you go to smaller and smaller scales, which is not great. But at the same time, you know, it becomes smaller and smaller as you go on larger scales, which is great for fundamental physics constraints. So this is shown in this plot. I'll demonstrate very soon, you know, this makes velocity modes a very promising, you know, a tool to detect like tiny deviations from the standard lambda CDM, you know, such as this local type non-Gaussianity I mentioned earlier. At these larger scales, you know, they kind of have an effect on these larger scales. Okay, cool. So one, reconstruct the bulk velocity or the bulk flows, you know, from these measurements. And this is the set of equations we arrive at. So we can, so you can see here the galaxy and velocity autospectra, as well as their cross correlations, you know. And essentially we use this set of equations to constrain fundamental physics. So here I added the ratio space distortions, or the Kaiser term, due to our measurements being, you know, in ratio space. So the set of factors here are related to density to velocity, and these bias terms are due to reconstruction. As I mentioned already, we don't really measure electrons directly on small scales, but we depend on, you know, galaxy distribution as a tracer of electrons. So our misknowledge of the electron galaxy cross correlation on small scales end up biasing our velocity reconstruction. So this is often referred to as like the KSC optical depth bias or the radial velocity bias, and can really influence like the prospects to infer parameters that may be degenerate with it. In that sense, that are essentially scale independent. So I'm happy to talk about it more. I'll be mentioning it more as I go further in the talk. But okay, so combining all of these signals, it might already be like obvious that, you know, the most major benefit from the collection of these set of equations or these measurements is our ability to essentially cancel out the matter power spectrum, you know, and constraining these other parameters that I'll be discussing in a second. You know, the matter power spectrum introduces a large cosmic variance, you know, that limits our ability to constrain the rest of these terms. However, it's easy but to see, I guess, by dividing, you know, these signals to each other, for example, that that these set of equations can actually cancel matter power, the dependence on the matter power spectrum, you know, allowing constraining these other coefficients, you know, beyond sample variance. So in that sense, the observables that are really relevant for cosmology here are these coefficients, which are essentially the cosmic growth rate, F, and the galaxy bias, BG, which I'll describe in a second, are sensitive to many deviations from this lambda CDM model. Like, for example, galaxy bias becomes a sensitive probe for non-Gaussianity. This is especially because of the clusters, you know, since clusters are rare objects that sit on, you know, the tail ends of their probability distribution. And sort of anything that deviates the probability distribution or changes the probability distribution, such as non-Gaussianity, essentially affects the abundance of clusters significantly. As a result, the galaxy bias really gains the scale dependence in the presence of non-Gaussianity. So here the this beta parameter can be calculated from a halo model. This alpha parameter relates to primordial fluctuations in potential to the density fluctuations. And recently it's been shown by people like at PI that, you know, KST reconstruction can actually combine, if combined with the galaxy surveys, can really push down the constraints on FNL below one, which is, like, as I said, an important threshold for inflationary models, you know, that are more complicated than a single field slow roll model. These models, as I said, just predict a larger value than this. Okay, so this is, like, really exciting. This will be the most, you know, sort of strongest constraints on FNL, it seems. But also it's important to mention that, you know, FNL enhancement is not the only non-Gaussian contribution to the galaxy bias. You know, if you write the autocorrelation, for example, you will see that, you know, the galaxy bias also gets contribution from the collapsed four-point function or the amplitude of the, you know, the tau and L, as I mentioned. For single field slow roll models, the tau and L is entirely defined by the amplitude of the FNL. So by some geometric factor, you know, but in the presence of inflationary, like additional inflationary degrees of freedom, such as a Curvetin field, for example, this tau and L can differ actually from this prediction, you know, by an amount, you know, proportional to the relative power between the inflation and the additional Curvetin field. So this measurement, if different from what is predicted by FNL, can really constitute to a relatively unambiguous measurement of an additional degree of freedom in the early universe. So the constraints on tau and L from Planck are, you know, on the order of thousands, especially due to the difficulty of measuring, you know, higher order correlation functions in the sky directly. But, you know, as to be shown by a PhD student at Hopkins, Neha, KST tomography can actually really probe this signal, you know, almost orders of magnitudes, you know, higher accuracy with the upcoming, you know, CMB stage four and the galaxy surveys, for example, compared to what is possible. So here you can see that the galaxy constraints are essentially limited by the cosmic variance and they reach some number around 20 or so. So these forecasts, I think, are for CMB stage four and a varying galaxy density. But you can see that the tau and L constraints are actually not subject to the same sample variance are actually much, much better or over an order of magnitude more. So it's pretty exciting that, you know, if, this KSC in the same with the same principle can actually will be able to tell us something about these additional, potentially additional degrees of freedom in the early universe by comparing the FNL measurements with the tau and L measurements. So I'm kind of excited about that. Another primordial signature, of course, is Isaac Oberschmidt perturbations, you know, either in baryons or dark matter or neutrinos. And among these scenarios, I mean, most of the Isaac Roshe scenarios are very well measured and constrained due to the fact that the Isaac Roshe models have a very, you know, distinct effect on the CMB measurements, for example, if they're in meta perturbations. But there are like versions, you know, one can imagine a type of sub-Isaac Roshe perturbations, essentially like remaining, leaving the meta perturbations adiabatic while having the Isaac Roshe in baryons in dark matter to show Isaac Roshe fluctuations in sort of a compensated way. So this turns out to be a very difficult like signal to constrain because CMB, so it doesn't appear on the CMB at leading order. But recently we've shown that, for example, in this scenario where there's Isaac Roshe in baryons and cold dark matter, the resulting, like this would result also in a galaxy bias on the account that when you have more dark matter but less baryons, it turns out that it's easier to actually produce galaxies compared to the scenario where you have more baryons but less dark matter. So especially when this type of Isaac Roshe is sourced by some early universe, you know, paradigms such as inflation, Curvetin model and Curvetin decay, we can see that we see that the KSC reconstruction with velocities can also constrain these over an order of magnitude better than you know, for example, galaxies alone. So this is also another potential signal. But more generally, all of this really motivates, and there are a multitude of other signals and signatures that one can search for. All of this really motivates to obtain multiple tracers of large scale structure or the largest scale modes, you know, when trying to constrain observables, you know, such as the galaxy number density as shown here. So these are sensitive, like galaxy number density is sensitive to many different effects and biases, you know, including redshift space distortions, weak lensing, you know, general relativistic, you know, corrections and so on, to just count a few. So in order to tell the difference between and constrain like unambiguously all of these effects, we will need to have, multitudes of tracers on these larger scales. So this type of tomographic, you know, methods that I'm introducing in this talk are also useful in order to achieve that. So they're quite important. All right, so let me just mention briefly, because I'm not going to be able to talk too much due to time constraints, a little bit about the other observational signature, which is the cosmological growth rate. So the cosmological growth rate gains scale dependence, for example, if the dark energy equation state deviates from being exactly -1. Or in that case, for example, the dark energy would cluster beyond the sound horizon, you know, as shown here, would have a scale dependent effect on the growth rate. If the neutrinos have mass, for example, or the universe have an overall curvature, these are all effects that would lead to a scale dependent growth rate as well. So I can talk about that more if anybody is interested. So far, I've been talking about cross-correlating CMB with galaxy surveys. Another thing one can do is, using a 21 centimeter as a cross-correlation component in the analysis. You know, the 21 centimeter signal from reionization, you know, traces the forming of reionization bubbles with electrons, you know, where like temperature and isotropies in the line of sight can also be sourced due to the KSC effect. In fact, we know that this will be a significant contribution to the CMB as well, as shown here. So this is the reionization KSC, and it's around a factor of a few smaller than the late time KSC. So it's smaller, but it's not orders of magnitude smaller. It's still going to be a significant effect on the CMB maps. So one can imagine whether if we can cross-correlate, you know, CMB maps with tracers of 21 centimeter in order to do velocity tomography as I'm describing now. So in this work with Matt Jensen, we have also shown that, dedicated surveys such as SKA with around a year or more observation time can in principle allow reconstruction of such, you know, large scale velocity modes. So for example, like for 3 years SKA survey, I think we find, you know, one can reconstruct, modes up to around multiples of 20 or so. So this is exciting, and it also, you know, among other things, actually motivates Yet another scientific goal, this time related to the CMB anomalies. So, you know, since one goes back in redshift, the reconstructed, you know, density and velocity maps become more correlated with the CMB anisotropy. So one can, in principle, get additional handles on constraining the anomalies seen in the CMB, for example. So these anomalies are the hemispherical power asymmetry, the lack of power on the largest angular scales, and various other features in the power spectra on the large scales. And as I just mentioned, the reconstructed velocities, you know, from cross-correlating the 20 mass centimeter temperature brightness with the CMB are much more correlated with the CMB primary, around 10% of more, and over an order of magnitude larger than compared to the late dying fluctuations on MOSC scales. And also very importantly, they show a diverse dependence on various large-scale contributions, you know, such as Doppler, Sachs-Wolfe, integrated Sachs-Wolfe effects, which might allow potentially, you know, having a handle on understanding how these anomalies are sourced if they're cosmological. Okay, any questions so far? If not, okay, let me delve into another velocity-dependent effects and briefly go through it. Which might be, you know, which might prove useful for cosmological inference in the near future as well. So this is called the moving lens effect, which with my collaborators, you know, we've recently shown in a few years ago that will be detected potentially with the upcoming experiments to high significance. So let me just briefly talk about it. I'm not sure if everybody's familiar with it, but. So in order to understand this effect, you should imagine a gravitational potential, such as a dark matter halo, that is moving transverse to the line of sight. The CMB photon that gets deflected into the line of sight sees an evolving potential and is subject to the ISW effect, you know, which has the form of the time integral of the time evolution of the potential. And a simple realization is that this time evolution can also be written as a velocity dotted with the gradient of the potential. Such that the change in the CMB temperature traces directly the transverse velocity of the halo, and it forms a dipolar, you know, pattern centered at the halo center. So this is like a zoomed out picture of the simulation. And we can even zoom further to see a unique pattern, you know, produced by this effect on the larger scales. But you can see essentially like the moving filaments producing a moving lens effect as well. But at those scales, those you know, kind of bulk effects are really dominated by the primary CMB. You know, you can see that this with this black line I've shown before, the lens primary CMB, and this is the moving lens effect. So the moving lens effect is, you know, significantly smaller than these other effects. But nevertheless, you know, we find that in cross-correlation with the galaxy, velocity templates, for example, it will be possible to detect this effect to relatively high signal to noise. For example, Simons Observatory with you know, various upcoming large scale structure surveys can reach, you know, a signal to noise beyond 10, and stage 4 will increase that by around a factor of 2 or so. So it's actually going to be detected in the near future, as we can tell. And one can imagine doing a little bit of cosmology with it as well. So the principle is the same. So one actually also, you know, goes on to this time reconstructing the transverse velocities, essentially by, you know, seeing how the bulk transverse velocities modulate the cross correlation between the CMB and the galaxy, and you know, by measuring the resulting statistical anisotropy and estimating the transverse velocity fields that way. So the set of equations are the same, we can imagine trying to constrain these parameters as well from this measurement, and also from like by adding radial velocity measurements from KSC reconstruction and all of them together. So for example, in a recent work, we have shown that in the presence of the biases of both reconstruction techniques, that this moving lens effect can actually improve some of the constraints. So what are these biases? So as I mentioned, that the the KSC reconstruction is subject to a bias of our misknowledge of how the electron-galaxy cross-correlation, what the electron-galaxy cross-correlation is on small scales. So this is called the optical depth bias or the radial velocity bias. But in the case of moving lands, there's a different kind of bias that is to do with how the gravitational potential is correlated with the galaxy. So we have another bias that in the transverse velocity reconstruction from the moving lands that is proportional to the small scale correlation between the gravitational potential and the galaxy. Now it's actually so in order to like overcome these biases, one can imagine having external measurements, using other tracers of gravitational potential or the electron distribution, for example. For the optical depth bias from the KSE reconstruction, this seems like a really difficult problem. And one solution, for example, is using fast radio burst dispersion measurements. So you would require a lot of these, and I think we are all still like working on it, or at least people at PI are also thinking about it, how to best do this. But it's a relatively futuristic thing to think about. But in the case of the moving lens, the situation is not or similarly worse. So the galaxy electron cross correlation on small scales can externally be measured by galaxy lensing measurements, for example. And it is likely that we will have some readily available external measurements to constrain the transverse velocity bias from the moving lens, which essentially makes moving lens an interesting observable, especially in the when there are like these additional biases that essentially reduce the statistical power of galaxy fields alone, as well as the KSC. So, for example, for the galaxy fields, the RST measurements can also be biased due to selection effects. So if one is trying to detect or constrain the cosmological growth rate in the scenario where the moving lens is essentially the observable whose bias is measured best, then it can actually end up improving some of the constraints. So in particular here in this plot, I'm showing F times sigma 8 as a parameter. And with various amounts of biases on the RST from selection effects, so varying from like 1% to 5% with these lines here. So these lines indicate the galaxy constraints using the RST effect on F sigma 8. As I said, the Kaiser term has the F dependence in it. So galaxies are also a probe of the growth rate through their dependence on the F through the Kaiser effect, but if the RST measurements are biased by a few percent, for example, in this recent work we show that the moving lens effect that can actually improve those constraints significantly, depending on what the actual bias will be. So even though the signal to noise of the moving lens is pretty small, one can easily imagine scenarios in which such measurements will actually allow improving our constraints on the fundamental physics and various other cosmological parameters. Okay, so I will, in the rest, like the remainder of the talk, I will be talking about yet another set of observable that is the polarizing of Zaldovich effect. But any questions so far? All right. Okay, so let me just introduce a little bit the polarized single Zaldovich effect. So when CMB photons scatter, from electrons, they also acquire a specific pattern of linear polarization that is proportional to the remote CMB temperature quadrupole, as seen in this picture. So the temperature quadrupole the electron sees in its rest frame, results in producing in the scattered photon a polarization pattern. So this effect is shown. So the signature from this phenomena is shown in this rather crowded plot, along with like more standard lines as you see here. So the blue line is the standard lens, CMB E mode primary. Lensed primary, yes. And the this red line is the beam out fluctuations from lensing. So these other lines here show contributions from the polarized Sunyer-Zaldovich effect, from scattering of the remote quadrupoles. The The dominant contribution, as can be seen here, is the remote quadrupole. The dominant contribution to the effect is due to the remote quadrupoles that are primordial in nature. So these would be arising from, you know, Sachs-Wolfe or Doppler effects at decoupling, or in the late universe, you know, the next most significant contribution is from the integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect. So all of those contributions give rise to a black body signal that is essentially very particularly pronounced at the reionization, you know, leading to the reionization peak observed in the standard, observed in the EMOV spectra, for example. But also, you know, when the fluctuations in the optical depth or the electron distribution becomes large on small scales, in this case, you know, PSC signal also gets, you know, a lot of contribution at the second order in density fluctuations, you know, when both E and B modes fluctuations are sourced. So I'll be discussing these signatures in a second. Another contribution to the remote quadrupole field arises from relativistic Doppler effect. So this kinematic quadrupole, for example, gives rise to a non-black body polarization anisotropy, which is referred as the kinematic polarized Sinus-Zaldovich effect, which also gets contribution at leading order where the optical depth can be approximated to be homogeneous, as well as on, or also on small scales where the fluctuations in the electron distribution is large. So I'll be discussing these in what follows. You know, while really subdominant to the polarization and anisotropies, you know, associated with the recombination or reionization or the standard PSC effect, this kinetic PSC effect has this unique frequency dependence, which allows it to be separated, you know, using multi-frequency CMB experiments. And it can also be templated if the velocities are known externally, for example, from a galaxy survey. So I will be returning to those, like the consequences of those statements in a moment. Okay, but among these effects, let me first focus on the standard polarized Sinus-Zaldovich effect due to primordial quadrupoles. So we can follow the same procedure as I described before, where we can also reconstruct the large-scale cosmological fluctuations from, you know, measurements of small-scale polarization in cross-correlation with galaxy surveys. So in this case, the cosmologically relevant observable that one reconstructs is the fluctuations of the remote quadrupole field, which is, you know, seen by the electrons that scatter off the CMB photons, you know, distributed throughout the universe. So, you know, this technique of polarized Sinus-Zaldovich tomography would give us the E and B parity remote quadrupole fields on larger scales. And then we can compare those to standard lambda CDM, you know, theory predictions, such as shown here. So we expect to see a scalar contribution that would dominate the E-mode parity quadrupole on all scales. You know, while the B-mode quadrupole field is expected to be zero unless, you know, there are primordial tensor modes. These dotted lines above show the anticipated reconstruction noise levels, you know, within the reach of future experiments. And we anticipate reasonable constraints, perhaps, you know, not at the level of low LBB measurements, but for the upcoming CMB stage, so we can use the tensor primordial quadrupole, for example, to see about constraining tensor fluctuations. And so here are some results from forecasts that I did recently. So it seems like, you know, the CMB stage four in cross-correlation with Barry Rubin Observatory, you know, will not really achieve a very, like, you know, strong constraints, but it might be possible with CMB HD, for example, to really, constrain R somewhat significantly. So these are relatively smaller, like, you know, worse constraints compared to the D-lens low LBB. But nevertheless, still, when we think about the current constraints, for example, like if you end up finding that, you know, the R is at some number, around 0.1, for example, it might be imaginable that even CMB stage four and the polarized Sinus-Zaldovich tomography can play a role in validating that effect. Or if it's, you know, around 10 to minus 2 or so, then the CMB HD and the polarized Sinus-Zaldovich tomography can actually play a role also in validating this. So I'm kind of excited about the role that the PSC tomography might play when it comes to validating tensor to scalar ratio measurements from the upcoming CMB surveys. So you know, it's also like all of this will be freely available from the data with no external like additional measurements. So it's kind of fun to think about what can be achieved with the PSC tomography as well. Like on that note, another thing one can imagine doing is probing cosmic birefringence, reconstructed, you know, from quadrupole essentially signals, where, you know, the E and B mode polarization patterns on the sky could rotate, you know, due to, you know, the influence of an axion like, you know, scalar field, for example, that might couple to photons, sourcing a non-zero cross-correlation signal, you know, between E and B parity signals, which could, you know, which shouldn't exist in the absence of this kind of phenomenon. So I was particularly interested, for example, axion for models that where the axion is like dark energy, where this rotation ends up being seen or like seen to occur at only late times, you know, after recombination more generally. So like the masses of the axions that satisfy, you know, axion to be a dark energy candidate are close to the Hubble scale. So the rotation ends up occurring at relatively high redshifts. And also like only when the scalar field, the axion field is rolling down its potential and arriving to its minima. So whenever that rolling down happens, that is actually where the cosmic birefringence occurs during that, you know, period and redshift. So people have been looking at it. This is a paper from Ishiro Komaso and others. And in particular, when masses that correspond to rotation occurring between recombination and reionization, it turns out that, you know, one can compare the birefringence from, or compare the, you know, the reionization peak to the rest of the CMB to be able to constrain the birefringence, the relative birefringence effect on these signals. You know, the CMB polarization has its own calibration angle, so it's usually really hard to tell what exactly is the calibration, so the birefringence on the CMB map. So there are other ways. For example, there's one can use you know, galaxy templates, assuming there's no birefringence on the galaxy, on our galaxy's, you know, polarization, and use that together with the CMB measurements to constrain birefringence that way. So those are ongoing works. I don't know how convinced the community is regarding how robust those are. But like, in addition, one other thing, without being really subject to this calibration issue, is essentially comparing, as I said, the recombination with the reionization, and simply seeing how that comparison might be changing with you know, cosmic birefringence. But for the, you know, the Hubble scale, the axion masses, which correspond to dark energy, with masses like really close to the Hubble scale, this rotation only occurs after reionization. And when that happens, it's actually essentially impossible to constrain cosmic birefringence by that, and like, you know, method by comparing the recombination to reionization. So if that's the, for the set of models where, you know, the axion mass is closer to the Hubble scale, where the, you know, rotation occurs on the high, like low redshifts, it might make sense to try to see whether if we can use the PSC tomography from, you know, redshifts and of large scale structure to constrain the signal as well. So Nanun Lee from NYU, a student that I've been recently working with, will be showing soon that this actually might be possible with the upcoming experiments, or more like planned experiments like CMB-HD, where one can combine polarized single-zone tomography quadrupoles with reionization peak, for example, and to see that, you know, one improves the constraints and also essentially produces comparable constraints, even if we don't have like some, you know, prior on the like the calibration angle, which otherwise the total birefringence is degenerate with. So in this plot, you see combining Lightbird with a CMB HD like CMB survey, and so basically the improvements on the errors are shown. Also, more importantly, I think, it might be possible to pinpoint where exactly this rotation occurs by, you know, multi-band, you know, sort of tomography of the PSC as well. So the PSC tomography will allow, you know, measuring the birefringence essentially in multitude of redshift bins and comparing different bins to each other, one can actually pinpoint where this rotation occurs, essentially constraining the mass, like beyond just putting upper or lower limits to it. So I'm kind of excited about seeing this true and seeing how the PSC can improve birefringence measurements this way. Okay, any questions so far? Okay, in the last few minutes, let me just finish by discussing potential cosmological applications from kinematic SC as well. So there's a, you know, so the peculiar bulk motions of electrons also induce, as I said, a kinematic quadrupole in the rest frame of electrons, which sources polarization. And this polarization is frequency dependent. And so basically, although it's really much more smaller than the standard polarized SC effect, for example, one can essentially utilize, you know, the frequency dependence of the CMB maps with different frequency bins to ILC clean, essentially to clean up the frequency, the foregrounds. In this case, foregrounds are like the black body CMB, for example, you know, from the measurements of the KPSC effect. So essentially it turns out that the background CMB can be reduced by, you know, orders of magnitude from ILC, and this can be utilized. This can be this ends up like resulting in the prospect increasing really the prospects of measuring this KPSC signal significantly. So here are some forecasts that show you know, various data sets and how they might end up constraining the KPSC in the near future. So you see, for example, that CMB stage four can potentially provide from the B-mode, you know, maps, a signal to noise over two measurement of the KPSC, and you know, HD beam can put like HD measurements can potentially improve that by around the factor of few. So this can potentially be detected in the near future, which, you know, is exciting on my part. And if you have many, you know, frequency bins, like the Pixie, the planned or proposed Pixie experiment, for example, that has, I think, frequency bins of sizes 15 gigahertz, between 3 gigahertz or 150 gigahertz and 3 terahertz, I think. So there's like thousands of frequency bins for this experiment. And in that case, one can almost completely remove the CMB blackbody and essentially really increase the prospects of detecting this effect. So this might be possible in the near future. And, you know, again, tomography can also be done in the same, using the same principles. In this case, reconstructing the kinematic quadrupole distributions or large scales. So these are some forecasts showing that the S4 beam might end up, you know, detecting or reconstructing the velocity modes or the kinematic quadrupole modes to sort of around 3 sigma to sigma, and HD beam can actually improve that by around a factor of 5 or so. So it might be exciting to think about this effect. Actually, in part, I'm excited because this effect traces effectively non-linearly the underlying velocity fluctuations. So it depends on the velocity square, and so velocity square fields or any density square field is actually an interesting tracer of cosmology as well. For example, one can show that the you know, locally quadratic field is essentially amounts to a collapsed four-point function. So if you know, there is primordial non-Gaussianity of the tau and L form, this would boost the quadrupoles that are reconstructed from measurements of the kinetic polarized SC on large scales, for example. So this is shown in this plot where various values of tau and L amplitude is shown to boost the you know, the kinematic quadrupole that can be reconstructed from KPSC tomography. So we've shown that in a recent paper that, you know, the constraints are not really compare well with the KSC constraints, for example, but they are nevertheless almost around an order of magnitude better compared to Planck with the upcoming experiments potentially. So these two lines show, you know, the difference between a scenario where the underlying electron distribution traces perfectly the dark matter on, you know, so that these are the lower constraints. And in this case, we assume an AGN electron model. So there's a bit of a difference, a factor of a few between those assumptions. But nevertheless, so the like the areas on the tau and L are essentially comparable, like around order of magnitude 100 or so. And these would, if detected, for example, like large tau and L values, this measurements can, although like super small signal to noise, can provide an additional way to measure tau and L as well. And then finally, of course, one can also do cosmic birefringence. You know, like for both the tau and L and the cosmic birefringence, as I'm describing now, like one thing to really keep in mind is that, you know, one can always reconstruct, you know, up to the how much the continuity equation holds, but velocity fluctuations on large scales from galaxy surveys and use those as templates. So in that sense, you would be comparing the you know, the remote quadrupole modes you'd expect to see by using a galaxy, the velocity template from galaxies to the actual measured ones. So in that sense, this also is, you know, can be done with using the KPSC as well. And this particular templating really improves the constraints on the birefringence compared to what can be done with just looking at this effect without those templates. So so here I show various, like, you know, results from an R analysis where we show that although, again, a very, very small signal to noise, you know, CMB stage four, like CMB HD like survey can constrain birefringence to around an order of a degree by just doing PSC tomography, essentially. Okay. Finally, let me say that, you know, we're at the place that we're not only, you know, conjecturing on the possibilities and various signatures and forecasting on them, but also working on really to assess the, you know, the prospects of doing this with realistic maps and you know, map-based techniques, including masks and foregrounds. So, you know, we have been finding in a very exciting way that the prospects to do KSC tomography, in this case, we only looked at the velocity tomography, is actually pretty promising. So it seems like, you know, KSC tomography will actually may actually work well, and then we can actually achieve, you know, like all of the promises of this cross correlation program from the velocity tomography side. For example, you see from this paper by Matt Huangquiso and others, you can see, for example, like the reconstructed maps in velocity actually match pretty well with the true maps for various different Reshef pins on larger scales. So this is all very exciting. And yeah, I want to finish by saying that, you know, we're kind of pushing that now towards hopefully including polarized SC and perhaps non-Gaussian, you know, foregrounds and things like this to really, you know, make this program, you know, even more robust in terms of like how realistic it is. It seems like really promising way to do interesting cosmology in the near future. All right, let me just finish there. Those are quite a few things that I had covered. But...
Yeah, okay, great. Yeah, thanks, Salim. So let's all unmute to give him a round of applause for his great talk. Okay, so are there questions for Salim? Yeah, Matt, go ahead.
Hi, Matt.
Hey, so you mentioned all sorts of interesting new physics that you could possibly constrain. What do you think we will constrain or find first? Or what are you most excited about?
Oh, I don't know. Well, there's this detection element as well. Like maybe we'll detect moving lands really soon, I hope. that's one of those things. But in terms of fundamental interesting physics, I guess FNL seems to be one of those, like, you know, immediate gains, and tau and L potentially as well. So I think like the first big scientific, I don't know, outcomes from this will likely be like combined measurements of tau and L and FNL from the galaxy bias. I would say, I don't know, what do you think?
That's the fun part about not giving the talk. I get to ask the questions and hear your answers. But I don't know. That's a great question.
Yeah, I think it's a great question. Yeah. Or maybe I don't know, maybe dark energy is super weird and it has huge perturbations that can only be detected by scale-dependent growth. And maybe that's going to be what we detect. At the end of the day, we'll be detecting some scale dependence on growth rate and the biases. The galaxy bias, and I don't know, we'll have to figure out what that might be from. I don't know, can you conjecture a little bit? was there something I missed?
I don't know, we all have our personal pet favorite things we'd like to know about the universe.
Yeah, non-virginity is exciting.
Personally, I'd really like to settle the CMB anomalies, and I think we probably.
Oh, yeah.
that would be my number one. I see. For sure, learning about all this other stuff too would be really interesting.
Okay, good to note.
Jesse, go ahead.
Hey, thanks for the talk. I was curious, so you had shown a nice map of what the moving lens effect, and it had all the sort of look pretty non-Gaussian and filamentary. And I know when there are people who try and measure, look at peaks and measure ISW profiles.
Uh-huh.
I'm wondering, is there some tracer beyond a two-point function that would help enhance signal to noise, or that would be interesting for probing this? Is it looking at
Well, I mean, it's essentially a three-point function. It's a statistical anisotropy that we're sort of how the power, varies over the sky in given patches as a function of transverse velocity. So it's effectively, it's a three-point function that we're using. But in terms of reconstruction, do you mean? But you're right in the sense that this is a nonlinear ISW effect. And, whichever way that you might imagine measuring it, is related to the is essentially also the way that you try to measure the moving lens effect too. So I can easily imagine there's probably a four-point function as well that you can write as an estimator for this. I don't know, you can do variations of the one-point PDF as if over the sky. And I don't, do you have any estimators in your mind?
Not well thought out. I was just thinking of people do a peak stacking thing for ISW.
Oh, sorry. Yes, so very specific features, I guess. Yeah, I think they're all related, they can be related non-trivially. Some of the things that we do in terms of actually trying to detect this involves stacking, these features on top of each other orientally so that they all align with some bulk velocity. You can extend that to various different things like filaments, I guess, and there might be some interesting things to think about. Thanks.
Okay, any further questions? Okay, if not, then let's end here, Josh. And thanks again, Salim, for your great talk.
Thank you. All right. See you soon.